This is the Blueprint Podcast, bringing you the latest in cyber defense and security operations from top Blue Team leaders. Blueprint is brought to you by the SANS Institute and is hosted by SANS Senior Instructor John Hubbard. And now, here's your host, John Hubbard.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Blueprint Podcast. I am your host, John Hubbard, and with me again today, we have our authors of MITRE's 11 Strategies of a World-Class Cybersecurity Operations Center, Ingrid Parker, Carson Zimmerman, and Kat Nerler. It's been a while since our last conversation, so I'm real excited to get back into recording here on our next episode. What we've got for today is Chapter 5 of the book. And Chapter 5 of the book, after covering fundamentals and knowing what you're protecting and kind of all this preparatory stuff, we're now to talking about incident response, which is one of the most important things that any SOC exists to do. Minimize incidents, and when they happen, make sure we can jump into action with professionalism and clean them up as quickly as we possibly can. So really excited to hear what we have to say about this one. There's a lot of detail in this chapter, so a lot of good conversation I'm anticipating coming up here. Wanted to start out asking about, again, the inspiration for the naming of this chapter. We talked a little bit in past episodes of what brought stuff around, but this chapter is named Prioritize Incident Response as opposed to Do Incident Response. And I wanted to ask, what is it that brought that specific phrase about? Is it that people aren't emphasizing it, or they don't know how to do it, or that kind of a thing? What was the motivation here?
Yeah, so I'll start there. I have a lot of passion around incident response. It's how I got my start. Also, if you don't have a lot of resourcing, this is where you really do have to start. You have to understand what you're doing about incident response before you can do any of the other functions that you have in your security operations center, in my opinion. And I was campaigning for the title Incident Response First. We had to soften that just a little bit to prioritize.
So you're the champion of the IR in the group here. What is it that about the IR stage that excites you so much, maybe compared to some of the other material?
Well, it's foundational to understanding our adversaries. So understanding how an adversary moves through a network, I didn't find any other way to learn about it except experiencing it, looking for how do they leave footprints. And, you know, if you have any excitement about, cat and mouse kinds of games and figuring out, oh, they did this, and seeing the creativity that an adversary might have. Sounds like I'm liking the adversaries, but I actually like finding them, and I actually like, tracing their steps and trying to, understand how they're thinking. So that's why I like it.
Yeah, and certainly I would agree, right? It's the problem solving and challenge and figuring out some of the more complex things that people have figured out how to do to bypass security that I think a lot of people get into this game for. It's like, I've been in that place as well where I'm looking at an incident. I'm like, wow, I'm impressed. Didn't know you could do that, right? And so, it's always an interesting thing when you get into this. Incident handling as a phrase versus incident response versus all of the other kind of terminology you might use for that. Maybe we should start out with the kind of definitions here. When we're talking incident handling versus incident response or any of those phrases, what specifically are we talking about?
I'll take a go, and I'll pile onto some of the things Catherine mentioned. One of the major reasons why I see people move into the security operations business and stay there for as long as they do, despite its hardships, and we're going to talk about some of the hardships today, is frankly the thrill of finding bad people doing bad stuff in cyberspace and figuring out what we're going to do about it. And it's really cool. Like, in a lot of ways, I would argue it doesn't get much cooler than this in most areas of IT. To your point, when we say incident handling versus incident response, we don't always necessarily respond. People who watch movies and see that absolutely terrible depictions of hacking in almost every movie out there, it's not nearly that glamorous, right? And most people who are watching this podcast know that. And I think one of the ways I think about incident handling is that, sometimes you are supporting an incident from cradle to grave in a way that is predictable, is professional, is consistent, and all those good words, and without emotion. We're going to talk about emotion as well. So response automatically makes people think that you're shooting cyber bullets in cyberspace, and that isn't always necessarily true.
Yeah, and just to emphasize what Carson is saying, I think that incident handling is a broader term than incident response. Incident response is a subset of what you do in incident handling. You want to communicate, you want to, you know, collect records on the information so you can trend over time and all those other things. So a broader term in my mind.
Yeah, and that's kind of what I was thinking when I asked the question as well, is I usually hear incident handling like referred to as the larger kind of whole organization involved effort, right, that it takes to maybe return to normalcy, whereas response is sometimes a little more like SOC and technical centric. I don't know if that's exactly how you think about it, but I know that some people use those terms in that way. So as we talk through it here, I wanted to make sure everyone was kind of clear what we meant when we maybe used one phrase or the other. Is that a fair way of putting it, would you say?
Yep. Yeah, and incident handling, I think, is, you know, we put a number of frameworks in the book that, you know, talk to this. One that we reference quite a bit is the NIST framework. And that really does that whole life cycle. You know, you start with your preparation and planning, you go into your detection analysis, you do, you know, containment, eradication, recovery, and then you have all those like post-incident lessons learned, everything else. And so it's that full cycle versus just the piece where you're going in and, you know, specifically dealing with that incident that's happening right then and doing that response. It's everything you do before and after it to make sure that when you get to that point of having to do the incident, it's less stressful, more streamlined, more professional. You can actually do the things you need to do.
So there's a whole section here, 511, on models, frameworks, methodologies, and resources. You mentioned frameworks there. Is there any specific kind of methodology or framework that you find yourself mostly gravitating towards during this stage of an incident, or anything that you find particularly helpful that we want to call out to the listeners right off the bat here?
I think there's several different frameworks you can use. And one of the keys is just have a repeatable process. Know what you're going to do in that phase. You know, we've referenced NIST, we've referenced Verus. I've seen all of those used in practice. And there's, like many things in cyber, there's no one perfect answer of this is the thing that everybody uses. But using at least one of those, because then, especially as you're going back and looking retroactively, you've got consistency to it. You've labeled things the same way. You've gone through the same stages. And that's really helpful for both your planning purposes and looking back and figuring out what you can improve on in the future.
So in terms of categorization and things that we might want to label, what are the things that are the most helpful for a SOC to look at when they're going through an incident? What type of, you know, categories are they putting stuff on? Is that breaking it down by the kill chain? Is that the MITRE ATT&CK framework? Is that all of the above and anything that you might want to put a label on? How do people approach that?
I've seen all of these. Certainly MITRE ATT&CK, you know, if you go back a decade ago, it didn't even exist. And now most SOCs use that as a way to put in some technical stages. A lot of times though, you, especially as you're communicating out to others, you might need something that's a little bit higher level, mm-hmm. something that is going to communicate to your executives, kind of the level of risk that you're experiencing. You know, so you might be talking about something like, hey, was this just scanning activity? Was this insider threat? Was this a denial of service? Was this phishing? Was this something else? So you may have categories that you use. Those can help with communications. They can also help with your playbooks. A lot of times as you're trying to figure out how you're going to respond, you can have these categories of information and you don't need a playbook for every cell in the MITRE ATT&CK framework. You could have more generalized things that say, hey, when this happens, this is what a human does. This is what our systems do if you've got automation in place. And they really help guide you towards a set of activities that you want to do based on those categories.
I would also offer, you know, putting together your kind of your pathways for this on kind of the back end of it very quickly becomes highly driven by the areas of the business and mission in which you are investigating and responding. And the more complex the business, the more points of contact, the more service owners you work with, the more intricate and more varied those SOPs can become. I've seen, you know, organizations have over 100 different playbooks or SOPs that deal with different parts of the business because they have so many different pathways they've exercised over time. And you never want you know, any of those pathways committed entirely to one person's memory and only that person's memory. You've got to get it written down. We'll talk about that too, I'm sure.
Right. And with categorization, it's important to point out that it's a way of developing a path forward rather than a definitive answer, because a lot of these will cross over several categories. So phishing is also a root compromise sometimes, is also, you know, a malware, is also, you know, there's a lot of things in these overlap. And to Carson's point, it becomes complicated if you have a lot of different groups that are responsible based on what category of thing it might be. So real important to keep your mind open as you move forward in categorization.
Yeah, I definitely want to get into the playbook thing in just a moment here. That's part of the next section I wanted to cover, which was the planning piece, which is 5.2 in the book. Planning, right? I get a lot of students in class that are like, hey, brand new SOC, right? We need to get ready for this sort of thing. What are the core activities for let's say, a brand new team in order to start getting themselves in a place where they can respond? What are like the broad high-level things that people need to think about in terms of forming a technical kind of incident response capability?
We'll be back after a quick break.
If you're enjoying this episode, then you're undoubtedly interested in building the strongest security operations team that you can. For those who want to go even deeper, did you know that SANS has not one, but two courses that cover security operations centers as well? For the leaders, managers, and directors out there, my co-author Mark Orlando and I offer 551, Building and Leading Security Operations Centers. This course covers building your team, your physical and virtual workspace, getting the right data into your tools, and then focusing on security priorities through everyday execution of important security tasks and building the best SOC team possible. For the technical practitioners out there, my course Sec 450, Blue Team Fundamentals, Security Operations and Analysis is designed to cover everything you need to jump in being the best SOC analyst that you can be. We cover important data types, SOC tools, security logs, malware, analysis technique, automation, and much, much more. In addition, if you want to prove you can deliver the best on any security team, both courses have an accompanying certification available from GIAC. That's the GSOM for 551 and the GSOC for 450. Check out both courses and free demos available on the SANS website. You can get registered today for an in-person course at one of our many events, or go to On Demand and take either class anywhere at your own pace. Thanks for listening.
I'll take a go. There's a lot of different ways to approach this. As I often bias towards being very pragmatic about it, I think about, you know, SOPs and playbooks and pathways and routines and rhythms. I'm broken down by the functions of the SOC that, you know, we've chosen to staff. And as we've discussed in section 3, every SOC looks a little different. So we want to think about making sure that there are SOPs and playbooks that match each functional area, each group of people, and that they feel like they own that and can improve them. And we also think about, you know, that planning for the major incident types we have. And there's nothing like a new interesting incident to seize that as an opportunity to write a new SOP or playbook, or take an existing one and add new stuff to it. One of the things that I like to talk about in planning, and I myself have written absolute whoppers of CONOPS, concept of operations documents, that describe in an absolutely succinct 372 different pages how a SOC is going to function. And one of the things I would offer folks should think about is, you know, putting every aspect of how a SOC functions into a giant sprawling document makes that giant sprawling document, although comprehensive, somewhat of a bear to update. And one of the patterns I would offer, especially for folks starting out, is don't think, oh God, I've got to get started on like this giant document to do everything. Think about breaking that up into pieces that the SOC feels empowered to update as part of their daily routine. If you do that, I would argue the SOC may be better postured to more rapidly improve in its capabilities, especially when it's starting out.
Yeah. And I think you can think about breaking this out. So you can have a high level, like what happens when you declare an incident? You know, you want to do something like have an incident commander, have somebody who's going to be, you know, responsible for what's happening. You might have a communications manager. You have people who are going to then be responsible for doing the analysis, other things. So you have all of these kind of structural things you put into place so that people know their roles and responsibilities. And then from there, you can have a set of documents that say, okay, depending on the severity, the type, the category you've put in, what are the actions you need to take? Do you need to, bring legal in? Do you need your communications team? Do you need to reach out to law enforcement? What kind of data do you need to get? Do you have to do data preservation? So you can think about this in terms of tiers from an overall, how do you deal with incidents overall? And then how do you deal with the specific incidents? And then what happens if things are going really wrong and it becomes much more of a corporate priority versus just a, hey, we've got to solve this technically.
Yeah, I know one of the things you mentioned kind of previously before we hit the record button was people shouldn't be doing this for the first time or thinking through it for the first time. Can you kind of expand a little bit more on that and kind of reiterate what you were saying before for the audience? Because I thought that was a really important point.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the fundamental things you do within a SOC. And this should be something where you have practiced, exercised, tried to do this as a tabletop, as a live exercise, whatever it is, be well before it happens. And we're talking, one of the other strategies about different ways that you might be able to exercise your SOC and do things. But, when you come to an incident, it's stressful. There's going to be a lot of questions. Your leadership might want to get involved. You may have external organizations that are also asking questions. And you want to be able to focus on the thing you need to do to figure out what's happening, not figuring out what your processes are behind that. And so, and this also goes to not just doing that preparation once, but having a cadence for when you do it. Because in 6 months, people's, positions are going to change. Their phone numbers might change. Your local law enforcement contact might change. All of these things might be different. You might have a new part of your business that's come in, something else. So you really want to plan and exercise this, not just exercising when an incident happens, because that is a form of exercise. Things happen and you pick them up, and we're going to after action reviews and those types of things, lessons learned, but really deliberately practicing, especially those bigger ones. What happens if you need to get all hands on deck? What happens if maybe you're not a 24/7 organization and an incident happens? Are you going to go to 24/7? How do you do that? How do you avoid burnout? What are the plans for everybody? So there are all these different elements that you can put into place and have ready, so that when it happens and somebody presses the button and says, oh, we've got something going on, you can just go in and say, yes, we do this. And we tested it out 2 months ago and we're good. We know how to do this. And you can focus on actually digging in and getting that adversary out of your environment.
Yeah. And to add, to that point of planning ahead before something happens, I think that's a great point. One counterintuitive point is to think about what kind of incidents you might experience right up front. Is it denial of service? Is you're a service organization where you really count on that service 99.999%? Or are you more concerned about your intellectual property and your research? And so maybe a root compromise would be bad on the intellectual property where it's all exfiltrated. So you really want to think about ahead of time, what are the kinds of things that you really care about? What kind of incidents do you care about in your environment?
Yeah, categories is absolutely one thing. And I noticed in the book you had, an example list of here's all the types of terrible things that might happen and kind of how severe they are. I also wanted to ask a little bit about at least how you've approached addressing the different tiers, I guess, of incident, right? Is a DDoS that's, super severe. Are you pre-planning a really bad one versus it's not really bothering us? Is there a major incident where we're planning for when we hit this level of severity, certain things are going to happen that wouldn't otherwise happen? Is that the kind of thing that you're suggesting there?
Yeah, I think a lot of times if you're exercising the big things, then you're going to be able to scale it back. If you don't need all of those resources, you can go with it. In my current company, when we are supporting a customer with what they're doing, we start the same way because you don't know how big it's going to get. Mm-hmm. And so we will spin up all the different pieces. You get your incident commander, you get your communications person, you have your technical lead, everything else. And maybe in 2 hours you shut it down because it's that wasn't a big thing that we really needed to go in and worry about. But you're starting fundamentally so that if it grows, you're not scrambling, at, 7 p.m. and going, oh yeah, this was bigger than we thought. And now we have to go, call everybody in and hit their pagers and do all these other things. We start kind of on that edge. But it is good to know that you have different paths. And so that comes to when can you cut it off and when can you shut it down? But I know other SOCs approach it differently. They do a scale-up model as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think Ingrid made some really good points. I'll offer two here. One of them is that if the SOC is supporting an enterprise that already has a pervasive or highly incumbent service engineering or IT culture, that's one way for the SOC to plug in and get started in terms of handling its incidents using some of the same parlance, such as severity and scope, that existing IT service infrastructure has. Because then, you know, when it says, oh, this is an incident of type blah, like people are like, oh, that's bad, or not, you know, and that there's not kind of that initial friction. And it's also worth reiterating for probably the fifth time, a lot of people who join a SOC come from, not all of them, but some of them, come from a service engineering / system / network / cloud engineering background. So, you know, there's some crossover there. I really like the point that Ingrid made. I cannot tell you how many incidents I've dealt with that started, like we got the initial call at like 3:30 in the afternoon local, and it took us a couple hours to figure out like, is this big or not? And by the time 5:30 rolls around, no one wants to get a call at 5:30 that something's starting. And there's always that initial fog of war. And when we spin up an incident, we go from, we have a thing that we know how big the thing is. So biasing towards a concrete set of things and calling people sooner than later, according to your SOPs, is a big deal. On the other hand, we also want to be thoughtful that we're not spinning a major incident for every little malware infection. And the SOC will get good at that and being able to make those judgment calls over time.
And that's a great point, is not everything that you come through that you're investigating is an incident in the big incident, yeah, you know, framework. There are things that you can do that are, oh, we just need to reset a user account, or we need to do X. And you may do more investigations and it might turn into an incident, but there are things that you're doing on a routine basis that aren't, you know, declaring big capital I incident, that are still things that are incident response, and that you're taking care of on a daily basis.
Do you have a special term you would use for those? Because I know, like in my previous job, it was incident versus major incident, right?
Yeah.
Which is kind of similar, maybe not the most useful way of doing it. But do you have a different term for the everyday problem?
Little incident, big incident?
I do. I think it snaps back in part to the parlance that the organization, the enterprise uses. Some enterprises, like the word event, is actually a highly loaded term.
Yeah.
And some, you know, incidents are highly loaded term. There are, for example, the word breach may have legal implications, or declaring breach. In fact, using the word declare, any context will make people's spidey sense tingle. So it's going to depend on, you know, your specific parlance and regulatory environment, at least in part. You know, again, if the people doing service delivery in the organization like have an existing parlance for like, this is a SEB 1 incident, this is a SEB 2 incident, or whatever they're doing there, that might be something worth snapping to.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? Borrowing the terms that people are already used to and kind of finagling where people have already kind of figured out how to use that terminology in a way that makes sense to everyone collectively. One of the things I definitely wanted to get back to, Ingrid, a couple times you mentioned roles involved in incident response. And I'm sure people are interested, like, what are the key people and roles they play when something big happens like this?
So, yeah, I think one of the first ones is the incident commander. And something to keep in mind with that is this doesn't have to be a technical person. This doesn't even have to be a senior leader. This is the person who is responsible for making sure that things are going according to that SOP, that people are fulfilling their roles, that if, you know, you're not able to get a hold of somebody who you maybe thought was going to be available or whatever, like you're finding the next person, that documents are getting filled out, if there's problems that need to happen, you know, they're kind of the overwatching of what's happening. But beyond that, it depends on, you know, where you go, but we often will see a communications person. So that is going to be that person who is actually doing updates on a routine basis. This might be the same, but you might have somebody who's separate. They're going to be the ones who are going to the technical people and saying, okay, what do you have? What's going on? You know, whether that's every hour, every 12 hours, whatever your cadence is. But they can be really important because your technical people are heads down in the data. And that is, especially in the first, you know, however much time, you don't need to be pulling them out like, okay, and please give me an executive brief that I can go pass this up. Like, so having somebody who is a technical enough, a good communicator, you know, good at writing, good at explaining, who does that kind of role. We often will see a technical lead. So that is the person who is going to be making sure that you're getting the right data. It's being accessed appropriately, that people, like if they run into, you know, needing different accesses, something else, a different tool, whatever else, that they can take care of that. Sometimes that is also your most technical person who's doing the investigation. Sometimes that can be somebody who's separate or more in a management role. And so I find that those three roles are often kind of a foundation. And then from there, you figure out what you need, in terms of the actual, you know, technical people, investigations, other things. And again, you're often going to have a senior leader or a set of senior leaders that are very interested. To the extent, if you're doing your communications well, then they don't need to be digging in because you're telling them, hey, your next update is going to be in 3 hours. And so rather than them going down and pinging that technical person saying what's happening, they know that they, hey, in 3 hours, that's when I'm going to get on the call and we're going to get everybody updated at that point. So, if you can form that first set of people, they can really help, keep you on track for going and doing the investigation you need versus doing a lot of maintenance management and communications outside off of track.
Yeah. And I've heard that incident commander also be like an operations manager or an incident lead. It kind of depends on the organization. So if you're a smaller organization and you're you don't like the word commander, incident lead is another one. That person can be the technical lead and, you know, the lead for the incident. But the key to Ingrid's point is that it's one person. It really has to be one person that can pull everything together about a certain incident or related set of incidents. Super important. An operations manager often is the person who comes up with the logistics for the organization. So it helps figure out who do we call, what is the process, who needs to be involved, how do you pull in other technical support if you need it, who does the analysis. The operations manager is a more usually someone looking across different incidents. That person may look at, oh, wait, this person and this person are leading two incidents. They may be involved. They need to talk to each. I mean, they may be related, so they may need to talk to each other. So there's variations on what Ingrid said, but the very key of all of it is that there is one person in charge of a particular incident.
Yeah, that's right on. We could all spend hours talking about this specific thing out of incident response. I'll offer a couple comments. One of them is, you know, the bigger and more complex the incident, the higher the severity, the more ornate this can get, the bigger the enterprise, the more ornate this can get. One of the things to think about when in larger incidents is, for larger SOCs or larger enterprises is, you may feel that one coordinator running that specific incident may become saturated, at which point it's advisable to start breaking out into different work streams, like a containment work stream, an investigation work stream, you know, a whatever work stream. Imagine I'm going to make stuff up. Someone, a service, let's imagine you have a major supply chain compromise. Right. And that starts spider webbing out. Right. And you may have a certain analytic investigative response focus, and you may say, all right, we're going to assign a work stream to do that. So they're miniature versions. And then you need to make sure those leads or those work streams are then representing what's going on back to that central coordination point. So some very large incidents may end up becoming a work stream sync every day, and then you have all the work streams report back in to the main incident sync. I think the main theme for so much of what we're talking about today is that within the scope of what the SOC is doing is making sure no single person becomes task saturated um, or you know, has become cognitively overloaded. And that leads to a lot of problems. One of them is it's just bad decision making or not having enough time to make decisions.
Speaking of which, you know, a lot of times we'll protect that incident lead so that they're not having to deal with phone calls coming in and all of that. So there's a function called triage, especially in bigger centers. It becomes really important that you have someone that's just monitoring emails and web and whatever phones, if people still have phone calls and, you know, chat and everything that's coming in, monitoring all of that at the same time, right? So usually having someone else doing that while an incident lead is actually managing the incident is something that's typically done in a bigger center too.
I'll offer one more point, then I'll shut my trap here. You know, when I thought about this field 10, 15, 20 years ago, big incidents that required the full measure of the SOC were more rare than they are today. I know this is like a giant cliche for all of us. Why is that important here? One of the things that large SOCs, new SOCs, everyone needs to think about is that if you've got a big enterprise to defend, there's a very good chance you will be in a major incident at any given time. So also having a rotation set up, not just for your triage, not just for people looking at alerts and phone calls and emails coming into the SOC, but also having a rotation for people who do the role of incident commander, incident coordinator, et cetera, has become increasingly important to reduce the burden and risk of burnout.
Yeah.
And I want to offer one more thing, which is all of us here have worked in very large organizations. But when you back this out to a small organization, you can still apply some of these fundamental principles, even if you don't have all these roles or something else. And I think one of the biggest ones is whoever's looking into the data, who's doing the investigation, try and separate them a little bit from the communications and from the external engagement. And literally, you may have just two people. So maybe you have your CISO is the one that has to do that communications, and you've got your SOC manager is the one that goes and actually digs into the data. But anything you can do to try and separate those, even in a small organization, is going to make you a little bit more efficient and is going to be less stressful than trying to bounce back and forth between those two different modes that you need to be in when you're dealing with an incident.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of communication and kind of keeping things separate and all that sort of stuff, any specific advice on platforms or ways to organize communication when there's so much information going back and forth between so many parties interested in so many different facets of this?
This is back to, I think, something Carson brings up a lot, which is what do you already have in place in your organization? You know, so if you've got, you know, if Slack is your major communications platform for talking about things, you know, you can run an incident in Slack. If you are using an incident response tool or something else, you can do it in there. If you've got a overall system that maybe your whole organization uses, and that would allow other parties, your IT, your legal, others to leave comments or see what's being updated, use that. The key is to find something that is part of your normal workflow and figure out what it is before and test it out before and have it be part of those exercises you're doing. So when you get to this point, you know what it's going to do and what its limitations are. Because not every, you know, no platform is going to be perfect for every scenario. So you want to figure out what's going to go in there. So I get less caught up in the format and more about what actually fits into your natural cycle. I will say when you get to large incidents, if you're still working through Excel spreadsheets, those become, and people do, because that's the place where they can store the data, that does become more challenging. And if you can put something in a more structured database where you can actually access an update and, you know, do things other than just adding another row and adding another column, that is preferred.
I'll offer a couple points here, plus one as usual. When we talk about communications in an incident, there are at least three kind of buckets of communication we should be thinking about and supporting. The first is real-time chat, as Ingrid mentioned. When we have an incident, we need to be able to quickly spin a forum that arbitrary people can join. And it's not just the SOC, and it's not just going to be the people the SOC knows should be involved in the incident. It's going to be a random user, a random service owner blob. So you've got to be able to bring those people in to either that into that chat or the other forums you've got. The second is the flexible and vibrant community of people who are going to be doing analysis, and they've got to have a place to put their analytic product. And that might just be two people, as Ingrid was talking about. But if you've got a major incident, even if you're a small shop, there's going to be more than one person who's got data and opinions about that data that are relevant. And they need to be able to see each other, and they need to be able to see the work they're doing. And in part because they need to understand the provenance and pedigree of both the data and where that data and where those queries came from. And they've got to be able to contribute, and they've got to be able to do that very quickly. And chat by itself is necessary, but insufficient. So, you know, think about any kind of common scratch pad place that can have, that is appropriate for the confidentiality of information in question, but that can be shared arbitrarily. OneNote is one thing I'm aware of. Google Docs might be one of them. Whatever makes you happy. I'm not here to expound on any particular platform. I would argue a wiki is not, by the way, because you're not curating notes. You are literally slamming down data and conclusions about that data minute by minute.
Yeah, the one complication I'll throw into all this platform and conversations and, you know, whatever you're using is, you know, we're speaking to a security audience, so I think everyone knows this, but you really want to secure whatever it is you're doing and really limit the access. So yeah, use what you already have, but also make sure you can sanction it off a little bit and, you know, sequester it off so that only the people that you want to have access, and preferably not the adversaries, can see it, you know, as you're moving forward, right? Yeah.
And we'll come back to some of that.
We will.
Strategies, but Catherine's absolutely right. The third of three buckets that I'll mention is task tracking. Littering your Google Doc or your OneNote or wherever it is that you're using to track with tasks can be challenging. Tracking tasks in the communications that go to executives, except at the most high level, like, hey, group X is going to do blah by tomorrow, is appropriate, but that's not sufficient to keep all of the people down in the weeds informed. So you've got to have another place to do that. And doing that in text can be challenging. So people usually like to use things that look like Kanban boards, because the number of the questions you're asking and the things you need to go to remediate can become challenging. With that said, we may sometimes come into what we all refer to as spreadsheet hell. Imagine someone busted open a key store or a certificate store in an incident, and there's 1,000 certificates in that. There's, you know, 100 stores, and there's 1,000 certificates in that. You know, you're not going to dole out 1,000 tasks in your Kanban board. You know, usually we revert to spreadsheets. So, and these things, the SOC will navigate as they come to it and as they do these tabletop exercises. Rant over.
Yeah, well, and I will say that, you know, making information quick and easy for at an executive level is extremely helpful to the comms part that Ingrid and Carson have both mentioned. If you have someone that keeps asking the same questions and the leadership still wants updates, having some summary somewhere has been invaluable, where you can just keep pointing them back to the, you know, the Word document or the PowerPoint to go get it, rather than, you know, leafing through all the chat and spreadsheets and everything else that the team is working on. So that was just a tip that I picked up along the way.
Absolutely. Baseline expectation. And in any major incident, you're distributing sanctioned, concise updates to executive on a cadence that is agreed upon in advance.
Yeah, I love the way of breaking that down, right? You have these different kind of things you need to communicate about, and each of them probably are going to take their own tool, right? Chat and analysis and tasks and all that kind of stuff. So unless, you know, Microsoft is going to build chat into Excel, which might be a great idea, you know, maybe in the future we could do all of that in Excel. Now, it's hilarious because every time I ask any question, one of the people in class always says, oh, I use Excel for that. It's like the universal tool for everything and all managers everywhere, right?
Well, you can at least search it, right?
So there's that, yeah. Okay, so moving on, you know, we've talked SOPs and plans and playbooks and all this preparation stuff, right? Now let's move into the detection and analysis. So the moment comes where that alert goes off and you're starting to think, yep, this might be the real thing and this is going to be a pretty serious deal. As an analyst, right, do you jump into action there? Like, where do you start on the activity? I know, Kat, you had some thoughts on this you wanted to share that you had mentioned before we started recording here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess what I'm passionate, and actually Carson's passionate about this. We might have argued this passionately before. I don't know. But before you take any action whatsoever, make sure you've really fully scoped and gathered all the analysis possible. Because what I've seen over and over, lessons learned, is that you think you've gotten the adversary, you've gotten them out, you go and you take action, and suddenly they're back in there again. Because if you don't get all of the instances of where an adversary may be, they're just going to come right back in, or they never left to begin with. So yeah, before you act.
Yeah, so you're right. I would say one of the things I would even, before even that, one of the things that we often see early in incidents is that it's gotten big, and we haven't applied our usual SOC processes to however big that is in time. And then people start going off in different directions and they're like, oh, I've got to go do the thing. And that incident commander, whatever you're calling them, and that incident structure hasn't yet shown up. And that's actually one of the most vulnerable stages that the entire enterprise is in between the time of, oh my God, I found a thing, to we're running this as a major incident.
Yeah, and I can't understate the amount of pressure people are under when they're doing incident response to act. Just fix it.
Yeah.
Just fix it. And the pressure is immense. If you haven't done it before, you'll experience it the first time there's something really bad. Why didn't you do anything yet? It's because we don't know that we've gotten it all. We don't know that we've seen everything. We're still analyzing. And analysis takes longer than a minute. It takes longer than an hour, usually, depending on how big the incident is. It could take days, sometimes weeks. So it's very uncomfortable for leaderships and incident responders alike to encounter that pressure of just fix it, you know? Right.
Yeah. Could you just talk a little more about that moment when, you know, it has started? Like, what are the actual things that people are doing to convince them that they're like, okay, now I've got it all? Like, how do you know that you have enough to then actually start jumping into the blocking and the containment and all that other stuff?
Well, the first thing I'll talk about is following various threads. So let's just talk about a root compromise, because these things all differ. It depends on what it is, right? But if you're talking about a root compromise and trying to figure out how many, you know, systems, virtual machines, environments are affected, you follow threads, right? You start with one and you trace it to where they may have, you know, infiltrated something else. If there was lateral movement, you know, this is where the kill chain comes in handy, and you can just kind of follow along. Oh, here's where they were looking. Here's where they were taking some data out. Here's where they moved to another system through a legitimate account. So that's some of it, right? Is trying to figure out what's legitimate versus what's not legitimate. So following threads is the first step.
Yeah. Absolutely. One of my colleagues has a phrase he uses, which is, where did it come from? Where did it go? And if you can answer those questions, then you've got a pretty good handle on what's actually happened. But if you have something that happened and you don't know where it came from, you don't have confidence that there wasn't something else that had happened from that. And if you don't know where it went to, you don't know if it's ended. And so it is that kill chain, but that's a real shorthand that we always use. If you can't answer those two questions, you don't know the full scope of what's going on.
And by the way, yeah, I completely agree with that. Finding that initial entry point is one of the toughest things there is. That is actually, if you found that entry point, you've got gold, because then Absolutely. You can really track it. But that's hard to do.
We often use the term patient zero.
Yeah.
Or the initial infection vector or whatever. I'll offer 2 points here. One of them is that that process of pulling those threads, going left and right in time, establishing the left goalpost and the right goalpost of the adversary, and bubbling that all up is tremendously important in an incident. One of the best terms I've heard stolen from the military is a common operating picture, meaning a shared situational awareness by all participants of the incident about what we know has happened in a succinct manner that, you know, everybody can understand. And having that comp is important. And to this date, you know, everyone often asks, you know, how do you put together your comp for a major incident? And quite frankly, the best and enduring answer I've heard is a directed graph that describes the major aspects of what the adversary is doing that are usually historically would be depicted on a whiteboard, usually scribbled out in haste. And today, because of our work from home and hybrid work nature, usually gets scribbled out in something in electronic form. Critically, they must not be what I'll refer to is as bug splats or dandelions, meaning graphs that are so complex you can't look at it on one screen. That's already too much. And so one of the things we think about in that incident is which of those parties we discussed is responsible for maintaining and updating that COP.
All awesome advice there. I know that a lot of people are going to be interested in this kind of thing. The other thing that I was thinking along the lines here of this topic is, what is a reasonable amount of time one might want to wait as a maximum once you realize there's a problem? Is there a simple answer to that, or is it going to be it highly depends. I'm sure it probably will be. But like, you know, are we talking, you have a day to scope it and then you got to start acting, or have you seen things wait weeks or months?
So yes to all of those. So the one that really, I have so many examples that have really stuck out. When your most important data is being exfiltrated out, that's when you start getting real pressure to, no, we got to stop the bleeding. We can't have any more data exfiltrated. So there's almost a balance between watching and figuring out where this adversary or adversaries may be and watching all the damage happen as things are exfiltrating. So, you'll get a little help on that from your leadership, the business leaders, because they'll tell you, we're losing too much. Stop it now.
Yeah. I think there's also a difference between things that are happening because the malware, the tool, is operating the way it's supposed to, the way the adversaries have done it, versus an adversary that's actually hands-on keyboard in your environment.
Yeah,
and there's a definite difference between, you know, something that, yeah, it continues on. Oh, it does this, and then it goes and downloads something else, and then it's creating a backdoor, and then it's doing whatever. Like, that is concerning and important, and especially if they start exfil data, you know, those types of things. But that is very different than, wait, somebody's in here and they just typed something, because you know that they, at that point, they are going to be trying to work faster than you are. And so you really have to step up and say, okay, this is one where we need to, maybe this is not an eradication at that point. It's a containment where you say, okay, we want to observe them a little bit more. This is when you start to put some boundaries in. You say, okay, we're going to leave them on that set of systems. We know what's happening, you know, but we want to disconnect, or we want to close down this part of their access or something else. And especially if they're hands on keyboard, you need to be very cautious about what you're doing, because at that point you have probably a more sophisticated adversary that I would not be surprising if they've created additional ways to get into your environment. And if you remove them from one, you have not removed them from everything they're trying to do.
Yeah, that's that point that Ingrid raised is utterly critical. And one of the reasons why, you know, trying to get to patient zero is as important as it is. We also recognize it's highly elusive, especially when you are facing a situation where your logging and visibility is highly incomplete. Is understanding the scope of presence the adversary has. And we'll talk about Cloud in more detail later. What I would offer now is, historically, people think about this as having presence on systems. One of the things to think about is it's also measured in terms of their presence in the identity plane, inclusive of keys, certificates, tokens, managed identities, and the like.
Yeah, I can almost see a list developing here that I don't think is in our book. That would be really cool to say, what are the list of things to know you better start acting? One is, if you know the adversary knows you're there, you've just lost a lot of time. Because if they know you're there, they're trying to figure out, okay, how do I stay when they try to fix it? You know, we can almost do this whole list here, you know?
And yep. it becomes really, you're right, Catherine, it becomes really nuanced. And it becomes really nuanced to the technology and environment in which, and the adversary that we're dealing with, and all that fun stuff. I've seen people do, you know, flow charts and checklists on this stuff. And this is one of the reasons why those incident SOP lists explode. And that's a good thing, right? If you've got a complex enterprise, that's okay. Don't fight it.
Yeah, that's one of the things I wanted to bring up is, like, I know there's a lot of different kind of heated opinions on this sort of thing and how do you approach it. The other question that was in my mind as you were giving all that advice is, what are the tactical items that people are putting into place once they're like, oh, it's here, but we don't want them to know that we know that they're here. How do you play that game of like, you know, spy versus spy? What do I know they know? What do they know I know?
And, well, I think you're really getting into that very advanced. I think that's chapter 11. I know. It's in chapter 11. When we start talking about deception and things like that, it's super advanced concepts. So you really want to go easy on some of that. But yeah, moving your most important data might be a good non-deception thing to do.
Perfect. So we'll save that conversation for later on. So listeners are going to have to listen all the way through the season to get to number 11. So I know there was another piece of this that Carson wanted to talk about, and that was the kind of potential for bias, right? When you're jumping into an investigation, we all come loaded with a list of things we either have or have not seen in the past, which may color our, you know, opinion of what we may be experiencing in that given moment. Could you speak a little bit about what you were wanting to chat on there, Carson?
Sure. And I'll separate this out. We want to cover kind of analytic bias generally, I think, in strategy six, because there's a bunch there. But for the moment, let's focus on and bias and response. And both Ingrid and Catherine touched on it. And that is in a major incident, there's a lot of pressure to act. And when we act, there are a handful of risks I can offer. One of them is acting with the incorrect scope, acting in a way that is utterly ineffective, so on and so forth. So one of the things when I break down incident response, when I'm, you know, plain incident commander or whatever, one of the things I like to do is, you know, we develop a game plan for how we're going to evict an adversary. And next to that game plan, I say, you know, you say you've got two columns. Column A is what is the outcome you want to achieve in logical terms? And then how are we going to do that? And that way everyone can gain a lot of clarity on what are we doing? Why are we trying to do it? And if we understand what we're trying to do, different people might bring different ideas to bear on, oh, well, have you thought about blank? No, I haven't. So that's a big piece. And I think one of the other, you know, things to look out for is just what we talked about. And that is acting before you've assessed, the extent of the intrusion. And I would always offer, you never get to perfection. There will always be residual doubt in the mind of the analyst, and coming to an understanding of that gut instinct of how much doubt do I need to eliminate before we can act. Is one that comes with experience, and it's one that comes through consensus.
Yeah. Right. And so the danger of acting on bias, the danger of bias in an investigation or an incident is getting it wrong. So an incident can often, especially if you're experienced, an incident can look like something you've seen before and then be totally different than what you thought it was to begin with. And that's the danger of acting too soon and the danger of bias. So you really have to keep the beginner's mind as you're doing this stuff and think, okay, I've seen this before, but is it really the same?
Mm-hmm. I would also offer, in my experience, the most times I see eviction and response occur, it's not where we see exfiltration, it actually like in progress happening right now, or actions, whatever other actions on objective are occurring. Rather, it's we now understand the extent of access the adversary has, usually measured on the identity plane, and then we're denying the adversary's ability to leverage that access they have in the identity plane. And that's where sometimes we will get into spreadsheet hell, because it is in a sufficiently complex enterprise, it's rarely just one identity. It's usually a set of identities and a set of presence, and we have to enumerate those.
Right. Yeah, I like that framework of you know, what is the outcome we're trying to achieve, and then how are we going to get there, and kind of brainstorming that list of ideas. I think that's a good kind of regimented, organized way of eliciting, you know, a whole bunch of brainstorming, you know, possibilities from people, and then picking out a good one to act on. One of the other things I know you had mentioned kind of at this stage that you wanted to get into was the true versus false positive versus false negative, and kind of the interplay between all of those things. There's a good section and table on this in the book, in the different four core categories of activity. What kind of instruction, I guess, would you like to give listeners on where to set the bar for setting alerts off and how to deal with the risk of false positives versus false negatives?
I would preface any conversation around true positives, false positives, the confusion matrix, as one of the probably top 10, if not top 5, sources of emotion and angst for every SOC. And it is that emotion and angst that pervades everything from why do I quit to what is someone trying to sell me? And everything in between. People have been saying, from academia to industry, for as long as I think all of us have been doing this, everyone has always talked about finding the better mousetrap to find more true positives and eliminate both false negatives and false positives. And everyone talks about, oh, you know, we're gonna deliver you better signal and have less stress for your analysts. And people have been talking about this for at least, 25 years? Long as I've been doing this. So, but I've gotten ahead of myself. You know, false positives are the bane of our existence, because it what keeps us busy with the things that turn out to be nothing. A lot of people have a lot of different feelings about this, but it's that load of all those alerts that keeps us all really stinking busy. And I've seen SOCs bias all over the map. I've seen them bias to where they're flooding their analysts with thousands of false positives a day, to where they're on the completely other side of the spectrum, to where they're only sending, you know, 5 alerts a day for an absolutely massive enterprise. And there is risk in both situations.
How would you find the best balance in between those two extremes? How do you do it?
This takes a lot of discipline. And two of the best ways I've seen SOCs find reality, find discipline and find humility, is testing themselves either through the red team or a BaaS, breach as a service, or whatever it is you're calling it today, product, and actually measuring their detection coverage against the threats and vulnerabilities that are most pertinent to them.
Gotcha. Yeah, I think it's solid advice, and kind of my, you know, approach aligns with that as well, as kind of looking at what your capability, you know, really the boundaries, right? Like what can we handle? What do we need to be able to detect? Let's test it. Are we actually detecting those things? Are we overwhelmed? And kind of finding that, you know, sweet spot in between all of those things is really a moving target and a challenge for every SOC out there. The next thing I wanted to ask about, kind of getting into our next section of the book here, containment, eradication, and recovery. We already went a little bit into watch and learn versus all that kind of stuff, but what we didn't get into is specific containment moves. Anyone want to speak a little bit on how to prepare for containment, both in the like, hey, I'm going to go take down a server, you know, what does that require? All the way down to like, you know, specific playbooks and like commands you might want to have at the ready for when you're ready to hit that button.
I think this is something where partnership is really, really important, because containment isn't always a SOC function. Many times it's not. It might be your IT. It might be the system administrator, the system's owners. And this is why it's so important to know who needs to be brought in early to understand what's happening, so that when you get to that phase, you're not having to walk them through, here's what we've been doing for the last 48 hours and why I need you to take the server offline in the next 5 minutes. Because that's just going to raise a lot of questions at that point. But it's figuring out when you feel you know enough about, you know, where did it come from? Where did it go? And then you've said, okay, what's the criticality of doing this versus not doing it? You've talked about those trade-offs. You feel comfortable and you're ready. And then it's working probably with other people to take action. Now, that is a little bit different as we've moved into kind of the SOAR world over the past decade, where you do have those automated actions that might be happening. So you have some things that are often, if you can define them easily, if they have low impact, if they're quick to take action on, they're more, you know, insular in terms of their scope, those types of things you might do very quickly. And it might be something where you already have it built in, or the SOC can push a button or do something. But a lot of times you're going to need that partnership, and you're going to need to bring in other parts of the organization in order to take that action.
One of the things I know I ran into that correlates with this is, you know, the empowerment issue of the SOC, right? It's like, oh, we don't trust you to go block things without a secondary set of eyes. And so, like, yeah, communication and trust between those other groups is going to be important for this. Any thoughts on how to build those kind of trusting relationships with other groups where you're asking, like, hey, can I go put stuff in the proxy that might bring down a critical service and you're going to get blamed for it if we screw up? You know, that kind of problem.
I have some thoughts here. I think we're all smiling because we have feelings about this and we've been there. My response can be boiled down to one word: practice. The SOC will have a menu of options that it brings to bear on how to respond to incidents. And over time, that menu will grow. And it will grow because of its different incidents it's handled and its maturity and capabilities and people it knows about and different incident types and blah, blah, blah. And when a SOC is young or meeting with a service owner or a business owner for the first time, this is actually one of the biggest areas of concern and emotion is, oh, you're just going to turn us off. Whoa, whoa, whoa there, Sparky. Don't say that in a meeting, by the way. and what I see in one of the pathways I've seen people practice that can be pretty fruitful is you start out with the SOC not being able to do it themselves. And they exercise that pathway of asking someone else to do it on their behalf enough times to where A, both organizations become familiar and comfortable with one another, and B, perhaps even more important, that other organizations like, you know what? I'm really tired of you calling me. Just do this your own stinking selves. And that generally works out pretty good.
Yeah, I'm laughing because that's exactly what happened with me in my experience several times. It was like, all right, we'll ask. And then, you know, the tickets, you know, flood in. They're like, we're not doing anything else other than blocking the websites you ask. We're like, yeah, that's kind of the game, right?
Yeah. So also, I think this is another it depends question. So maybe this is where playbooks and planning are super useful. So if you have to take down your whole Active Directory and rebuild it, you better be partners with your IT organization, right? So, but if you're just, you know, you have one instance of malware, you know, that's probably something, you know, you can just do on your own with your own two people if you're a small SOC. But yeah, so it depends. So you want to partner and you want to talk to them ahead of time and tell them what could happen, right? So here's what's going to happen if our entire domain is owned, or our own forest or our Active Directory or whatever, and work with them on here's how we're going to work that out. That's where playbooks come in.
This is an interesting area, John, where you talked about the confusion matrix, whereas false positives are a very important context. The SOC over time will have that menu of options that it can implement itself or its partner organizations. We must always remember what the false positive condition looks like for any response action we take, so we know how we can back it out. And we have to double down on that approach when we start shifting over to automation and SOAR.
Oh, let me just echo that. I mean, for sure, you don't want to approach anyone with, we're going to take the whole Active Directory down. Unless you're positive, you got to take down the whole Active Directory, because you'll only be able to do that once. You know, if you do that and you're wrong, you know, because of a false positive, you're going to be out in the field.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. The best, and this goes back to the COP and partnership. Every time the SOC is taking major actions, the ideal situation you want to be in is that the business, service, executive owner, whoever it is, or the thing you're going to act on is looking at and holds the same opinion that the SOC does. That isn't always necessarily the case. And it takes a long time of, you know, getting cyber culture built into the organization to get there, and accountability and all those other good things with having a healthy, larger cybersecurity apparatus. But the ideal situation you want to be in is where the business owner wants to act in the same way that you do, and you're on the same page. That's how you know you've gotten to a good place.
Yeah.
That's right. And take a beat, as we've said throughout here, just take a beat. If it's a major incident and there's a lot of things that have to be taken down and rebuilt that really affect the business, take a beat, make sure the analysis is right, make sure the leaders are on board, because if they're not, you don't have much chance of getting the adversary out.
Right. Yeah. Speaking of painful things to take down, one of the other things in this section, which I'm jumping a little bit here, I feel we'll end the episode kind of on the post-incident activities. Cloud, OT infrastructure, things like that. You have kind of some call-outs specifically for these at the end of Chapter 5. Any specific considerations you want to call out for preparing for, acting on, and kind of post-incident containment, any of that stuff for cloud environments specifically?
I can say a few things about cloud. I also want to talk about PIR in just a moment. I'm very passionate about PIR. Talking about cloud, one of the things to think about, I remember reading some of my first books on incident detection or intrusion detection and incident response. God, I feel old. 20 years ago, more than that. And at the time, computer forensics, in particular, Windows Disk Forensics and incident response, were like considered like two completely intertwined subjects. And now, many of us, billions of people run Windows, and yet Windows Disk Forensics is like literally a footnote in the slides we presented on the book. And one of the reasons why I make that remark is when you have entire services, entire businesses that are built in non-on-prem, non-IaaS environments, that's not relevant anymore. Still important to the SOC, still worth having a Windows Disk Forensics person on staff, particularly in larger SOCs or outsourced if you're not. So in this context, when we think about doing incident response in the cloud, the analysis is going to feel a whole lot more like log analysis at scale. And the containment and eradication is going to have a very strong emphasis at the identity plane rather than the network plane. In fact, if you're even in on-prem, you're probably already thinking about that as well there. But in cloud, we really think about acting at the identity layer. And we also think about having a nuanced visibility and understanding of the applications, right? The PaaS and SaaS type situations. And that is actually forcing today, I've spoken at SANS about this, and that is forcing the SOC to do a lot of things it kind of like was supposed to be doing for the last, 25, 30 years, et cetera, but now is forced to because there's no host to instrument in a lot of these situations. So I think those are the things that bubble to my mind straight away in this area.
Yeah. So falling back on log analysis, making sure you're familiar with what those logs are, you're actually gathering those things and kind of consider those threat scenarios, right? It's like if a Salesforce or whatever it is, right? Some SaaS application were to get compromised, would we even see it? What would that look like? Right. Yeah. Kind of planning those things ahead of time. Does that translate to OT and ICS and those types of devices as well?
I think there's some different considerations there because I at least have observed that people look at, there's like specific OT protocols, there's things that are happening with those environments. And then there's kind of the infrastructure that supports those, which is often, up to a certain point where you can still monitor and see what's happening in that space. So you really need to define what you mean by OT in your environment. You also have to understand if you're really talking about systems that do have their own protocols and, you know, are running maybe more independently versus something like building automation, which might be, you know, still running over a traditional IP network or something else. So I think with all of these, there's a lot of terminology and confusion that comes in, and they seem, especially as you're newer getting into this space, and I still consider myself newer getting into this space because I come from an old school, you know, SOC type of stuff, but it's spending the time to try and break it down and say, okay, how do I think about how the data is being transmitted, where it's going to sit, what I have access to, what I can look for, and what logs I can get to that are going to help me understand what's happening. So I think for anybody who's working in these spaces, try and get less caught up in like, oh, this is new or this is different or this is weird, and just go back to some of those fundamentals. Do you understand how an adversary could get into that environment? What logs, what data would you need in order to be able to identify if that is happening? And that's going to apply against all of these different pieces, you know. So you just mentioned SaaS applications related to cloud. You know, the fact is you don't run the infrastructure, you don't run the application. Really, the only thing you can think about is your own configurations and the identities that are accessing them. So that's where you need to have the logs that are available. With cloud, again, you might not be doing, you know, you might not be running the infrastructure, but maybe in that case you are running the application, so you need the application logs. Same things with OT. You need to know what you can actually go and get logs on and how you can bring those back. So it really is thinking about visibility to make sure that you can then go do the analysis on top of it.
Yeah, we would probably need a whole session to deal with OT, because not all OT, ICS, and all its variants, they're not all created equal, right? So some of it is on our networks, some of it is being run over it, and hopefully some of it is not, right? So there's the traditional like manufacturing and chemical and all of these other OT that are out there, and they're generally other teams that are working it than a security operations team. So I think that's the first thing to make clear to everyone, is that there may be OT and you should go find it and know where it is and know where it is in relation to what the security operations center is monitoring. And I'll leave it on that for OT, but that's a whole world that's exploding right now.
Yeah, I'll offer one comment there. I would say, generally speaking, in OT, ICS, SCADA, et cetera type situations, that tendency for the SOC where it feels like it needs to engage to understand the environment and to respond to it, is like that many more times important in those venues as elsewhere. And the easiest way, I think, for the audience to think about how critical that is, you know, think about badging systems as a form of OT and how absolutely awful it would be for the SOC to get incident investigation and response wrong if it took down a badging system for an enterprise. So and just keep that in your minds is one of my pieces of advice.
Yeah, develop some inquisitiveness about what, I wonder what that is and where it is. Yeah.
And what do we do about it?
Yeah, what do we do about it?
Yeah. So a lot of that revolves around still continuously, you know, gathering logs and making sure you know what to look for in those logs. And even though maybe it's not the same logs or as many logs as you would get from on-prem, you have full control style device. Mobile is a little different though, right? Mobile is like, maybe you kind of get the logs and some of the visibility, but a lot of it's a little more locked down and a little bit more complex to try to make sense out of than, you know, computers, right? That we still generally are running Windows or some operating system that we can put log agents on. You know, mobile to some degree, depending on how much you know, mobile device management and other stuff people can do, is a whole different game. First question I want to ask is, how often do you see a mobile compromise? Is this something people need to realistically worry about if they're not like working at the NSA or like some super high profile person? Like, does this happen at the average company?
For sure. And it goes back to the identity plane that Carson has mentioned a few times now. It's generally around someone's identity that it starts, you know, and goes from there.
So mobile as a route to taking the credential material that then lets them continue on into the environment is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. And what is the, like, the forms that takes? Is it, you know, phishing via text message? Is it malicious applications? Like, what have you seen that leads to that first step actually working on a mobile device?
Okay. yes. Yeah. So, go ahead, Carson.
Question. It's both. You're right. I think before we continue on this one, we should probably bound what we're talking about mobile. I think we're all thinking of things running Android and iOS. Mm-hmm. John, in this context, are you also talking about BYOD and Windows and Linux and Mac based personally owned devices in this context?
I guess I was not thinking about that when I asked the question. However, if that's in bounds of the book, then we can answer it that way. Let me rephrase the question. I mean,
it's a big question. I think that's why we're
saying.
All right. So let me rephrase this and scope it to mobile and like actual phones and things like that. So with those kind of intrusions where we're seeing passwords that are being stolen from like a mobile device, iOS and Android and things like that, what are the most common kind of delivery vectors and things that are bringing attackers success that you've seen?
I think it's, you definitely get, phishing, things that are coming over SMS. I think it's also... it kind of ties into identity and MFA exhaustion. You know, a lot of users now have secondary things that they need to do on their phones in order to authenticate, which adds that more security. But with MFA exhaustion, it's like, oh, you're going to get it and you're going to get it and you're going to get it. And a lot of times people just have their phones and they just don't think about them in the same way. And they're like, oh, something must be going on in the background, must be whatever. So they just click yes. And so those phones themselves are maybe not the thing that is being infected. But they, because of the ubiquitousness, because of how easy it is, and because they're just perceived differently, they're used as part of these bigger actions that are going on to try and get that identity and get that set of credentials.
I would offer on top of that, one of the things to think about for mobile as well as other fora is token stealing. People will often authenticate to their enterprise services from the mobile device, be it company owned or personally owned. And then, thanks to persistent sessions in web browsers that we don't usually close, those we're at risk of having those tokens stolen. And, this is opening up a lot of opportunities for those kind of phishing waterhole type attacks for adversaries. And having it on mobile devices can make that very frustrating, particularly when their system, there are devices that don't have an MDM on it. Mm-hmm.
And if we want to talk, if we want to talk about what we see most commonly, it's honestly just like it's kind of more human and user based. Our company has a joke about how long have you worked there before there's a message from our president asking for a gift card. And so those,
I've seen those too.
Yeah. Hey, I'm in a meeting right now. Could you please go get a gift card from wherever and, give me the number because I need to close this sale or whatever it is. So there's a lot of these just very simple, low hanging types of things, but that require user education. We actually have a module in our onboarding now that says, if you get a message from our CEO, well, he likes you. This is not, he's not asking for gift cards. And so those types of things really are still very common and very, very prevalent in terms of trying to reach out to users.
So people don't need $5,000 worth of iTunes credits?
If you want to send it to us, that would be great.
Yeah. So, on the flip side of that, right, have you actually run into a number of cases where people's mobile device actually gets broken into and, like, there's malware actually running on the phone as opposed to being used as part of a compromise to steal material?
I have not worked in... I will say there are a lot of SOCs that still... don't monitor their mobile devices.
Right.
They just aren't bringing that information in. That being said, having worked with government and government agencies, certainly have seen that. And there are, particular pieces of malware out there that are specifically designed for getting on mobile devices, often against journalists, against advocates, against others that are in particular types of user groups. Pegasus malware is one of the most well-known. And so if you are working for an organization where, and we're going to talk about threat intelligence next, where you start to figure out, who's being targeted, why they're being targeted, other types of things, it does exist. It's very much out there, and it certainly is a vector that adversaries are using. But it's not
If you have to make a choice about what you wake up and look at in the morning, you're probably going to want to go check your Windows system, you know, or even at this point, your Mac or your Linux system first, versus thinking about mobile.
Sure. Yeah, that's kind of what I figured the answer would be. But I did see you had the sample mobile attacks kind of table in the thing. And I was like, oh, I wonder if they have some stories on. I'm sure you probably couldn't talk about them anyway if you did have specific instances of that. But I did want to have everyone here like, yes, there is mobile malware. It's not just password stealing.
Yes, there is.
Google Pegasus, right? If you want to know about it, listeners. Yeah, it's a very, very interesting kind of world there. Okay, so to wrap this up, final things, right? Post-incident activities. So you've fix the smoldering ruins of your environment. Things are relatively back to normal. What do we need to do to kind of close up an incident that has occurred?
I can talk about this. I want to start off talking about post-incident activities, post-incident response, PIR is insane. It may not seem very glamorous, but I would argue being good at PIRs is actually one of the best ways the SOC can get better and be the engine for change in the entire enterprise. One of the things that I like doing during any medium or larger sized incident is actually during the incident, early in the incident, starting a scratch pad of what I affectionately refer to as PIR slop. And what that is it's not a complex form. It's not a big Kanban or DevOps system. It's a quick space that people who are involved in the incident can jot down notes in the heat of the moment, usually less than 30 seconds, on something they saw that didn't go well for them. And through the course of the big incident or even the medium-sized incident, they collect slop. And at the end of the incident, as an organization, for the people who were directly involved in the incident, the most active on that incident, they have what I'll politely and affectionately refer to as a slop grooming session. They go over as a group the things they didn't go well for them and decide what are they going to actually turn into something that needs to go get actioned. And what they go action is going to depend on a lot of things about, like, does the SOC feel it has the cycles? Does it have other people who can help them champion major efforts, et cetera? And those PIRs span from I didn't have data type blah to Mary didn't know about SOPX to, oh my God, stop putting creds in code, and everything in between. And one of the things that so there's those internal PIRs that the SOC can go admire and internal the way it's doing, go deal with the way it's doing business internally, which is cool. And then there are the external PIRs where it needs to find a champion for, track and burn down over time. One of the things that the SOC can think about is that during a major incident, it will collect problems it's seen in the way the enterprise at large is doing some aspect of security that may not be immediate or urgent, but still needs to be addressed. And that's one of the best ways PIRs are to make note of that. Don't forget it and come back to it so that the incident is not going on forever. And this is where the SOC should either have its own PIR champion or a PIR champion somewhere in the cybersecurity apparatus to track those, rack and stack them, rank them, whatever makes sense, and then actually pursue over a period of time and finding other people to help champion them and help drive them is critical. What should not happen for PIRs is that the very same people that just got burned on an incident are now responsible for driving them, or the PIRs go back and come back in. We call those boomerang PIRs.
And I have two comments on this. First of all, I think to back up for a minute, post-incident reporting and having the conversations afterward is one of the most important things to do if you want to evolve your SOC. And it's also one of the things we forget the most. It's one of those things that, we don't have time. We're just moving on to the next thing. And that's where we lose our opportunity to grow and to make things better. The other thing I wanted to point out is having ground rules when you're having those are really important, because people won't talk if they feel like they're going to get blamed. So it has to be one of those no blame. We're all just going to talk and figure out what needs to happen. And you'll get, it needs to be a safe space for conversations. Otherwise, you won't get the lessons learned that you're looking for.
Yeah. And Carson hit on really the two big things I always think about, which is there's a set of things about responding to an incident, the process you went through, the people, the communications, everything else. But there's also a set of security things that you can come up with. Said, because of this incident, we learned we could have had this prevention in place, or we needed to, you know, do X or whatever. And those are often external to your SOC. And so when you have these sessions, inviting in people beyond just the SOC to have discussions and to hear what's happening so that you can work with them, especially on some of these things that are more of a prevention and a security focus outside of the processes that you're doing internally with the incident.
Absolutely. I want to double down on the comment that was made about growth mindset. I mean, it's important then when we approach PIR is that people put their mind into a no blame growth mindset type pattern of thinking. Otherwise you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. I love all that. Making sure you don't forget anything, an important one, right? That's one of the most crucial things. Everyone's like, oh, I'll write that down later. But we all know that you're going to forget what it was later, right? Yeah. No blame, growth mindset, inviting people beyond the SOC to make sure you get that full point of view. All absolutely crucial stuff for success in this stage. Anything else you want to throw in before we wrap it up?
I would just offer, you know, incident responses while we're here, kind of coming back, John, to some of your first points, Ingrid and Catherine as well. Incident responses while we're here, it's the most important thing that the SOC does. Getting good at it takes time. And, you know, you're never done getting better at it, just like every other area of SOC operations. It's also a big point of stress. So I'll just double down on, you know, having as much written down about your incident response pathways is always going to help you kind of de-stress. And don't forget to rotate responsibilities. Don't just have the one really smart lead responsible for, you know, all major incident coordination. That's how you create a lot of risk for your whole organization. And I don't just mean to people leaving. I also mean to that person getting burnt and making the wrong decisions in the heat of the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, management of stress is definitely one of the biggest things that we didn't talk extensively about here, but will absolutely tank the effort if people are just burnt out and overworked on this kind of thing. It's already stressful enough without making people work too many hours and putting too much burden on them with other tasks. So yeah, awesome stuff. This episode was full of gems. Had a great time here. Thank you so much for joining us for this one. We're going to be back next week with our episode on Chapter 6, Illuminate Adversaries with CTI, which is going to be a really fun one to discuss as well. So thank you for all the listeners for hanging around with us. And thank you to the authors for joining us for this one. We will catch you again on our next episode of Blueprint. Bye, everyone.